Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 6, delivered on September 8, 2016. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, ratio analysis. Before the lecture began, I was blathering about finding a company to use for the ratio analysis, and someone here, who suggested Domino's? I'm impressed. That's actually a decent company, except that I'm standing here. My color right now is meatloaf dense. There's something there that actually surprises the heck out of me about this company. Can you see something in the screen right there? If you can't, don't worry too much about it. If you can, maybe I'll give you a cookie. Yeah. Yes, the beta. What's that beta? Yeah, 0.28, that is a low beta. That is a safe beta. That is a playing handball on the curb beta. That's not that much worse than a treasury bill. Domino's, a pizza place? Who knew? Those were safe stocks. I mean, okay, and it's market cap is 7.23 billion dollars. Really quick now, DPZ. I'm going to pull up Edgar on this guy here, Edgar. DPZ, and. Well, there's a Q. They've got a couple of Qs out there. Here's their last K. I'm going to go to the interactives on this. And I'll do this enough that eventually you'll kind of get the idea of what I'm after here. But I'm going to look for the balance sheets. Okay, that really helped a whole lot. Consolidated statements. Oh, duh. Clicking on the wrong one. Okay, now, real quick, let's look at the book. Oh, isn't that interesting? The accounting statements say the book value of this company is negative. You see it? The book on this, total stockholders' equity, is negative $1.8 billion. So that from the financial statements, this is a company that is on the ground with one of its hind legs kicking. And notice that it has gotten worse year over year. The total stockholders' deficit has increased. But if we go over here and look at the market's assessment of this company, this is a very safe investment, and this company has a positive market cap. So, which one are you going to believe? The what? I'm not. I will believe what the market says. Okay, you're playing Dungeons and Dragons. Okay? And you've got your book, and it says, little mean fairies are going to be bothering you on this. You're reading it right there in the book. It was made by an accountant turned geek. So you got this, you're thinking this, but out there you look up and you see a dragon. Wait, fire breathing dragon. Oh, my beard. Dodgy lighter. Okay. Which is going to drain your health? The little fairies that they're talking about in the book, or that dragon that's going, yeah, the dragon. Okay? The point being that the market is going to be what makes you rich or poor, not those financial statements. That's another cautionary tale about this, is that you have to watch it. The market's saying, the market says, is a little bit of a problem there is. But interestingly, this company is even still paying a dividend, the dividend yield. Now, the dividend yield, follow with me. I'm sneaking in these financial ratios as I go along. It's kind of how I do things. I try to make it a little more real this way. The dividend yield is the dollar amount of dividend per share divided by the price per share. So in other words, it's sort of like when I put money in a savings account, this would be the savings account rate. But you also will gain on the sale of the stock if the stock goes up. So there's two parts to how you make money on a stock. There is the capital gain, the buy minus the sell. Wait, sell minus the buy. And then there is also those dividends you get along the way. Now, a dividend-paying stock is generally a safer stock because at least you know you're going to get this dividend check, even if the stock doesn't go up in price. But you pay for that dividend in terms of the ability of the company to grow. In other words, it's giving you a dividend instead of plowing money back into operations. In this case, Domino's is clearly financially in some trouble. I mean, it's there in the, at least on the accounting side. But the dividend, it's paying a dividend. I'd want to see if it was able to consistently do that. It's got a positive market cap. Market says, well, there's some value in this company's equity. It's got a low beta. That volume, you know, that's I'll teach you about volume as time goes along. A term that I need to bring up, and I should have done this in the earlier. Fundamental analysis means that you will take numbers, but then you will look beyond the numbers. Back in my time, we called the fundamental analysts the wizards. Technical analysis is purely driven by numbers and charts and old-fashioned rules that God knows where they came from. They're just kind of invented, seat-of-the-pants kind of stuff, but it's all numbers-driven. We used, back in the day, we called those people the elves. And you'll still hear that term a lot. Well, we're going to talk to the elves at such and such a brokerage house, see what they have to say. And then you'll hear them talking about charts and showing uptrends and downtrends, necklines, candlesticks, stochastics, all kinds of, pretty much most of it is mythical and folkloric, but, you know, they do it. That's their thing. It's sort of like going to a chiropractor. Somehow it works, but God knows how. But anyway, so if you're an elf, you want the numbers. You don't want to think about what's going on past the numbers. So an elf would look at these, and then it would he or she would look at the financial statements and then have an elf meltdown. You ever seen that? An elf meltdown? Okay, think about, you know, in Sleeping Beauty or one of those. That was dwarves, but they're like that. Think about a dwarf who suddenly woke up one morning and he realized his life was meaningless. Snow White was never going to love him, and he was short, and he didn't know it, but all of his other elves called him Hogface. That's an elf meltdown. You see, an elf would look at this and say, well, there's something really wrong here. This company is overvalued because I can see the financial statements say that this company has a negative book. The market says it has a positive book, so obviously the market is wrong. Okay, now fundamental analysts would say, yeah, I see this. I never trust financial statements. I always trust a market more than I do financial statements. And in this case, is there a Domino's here in town? Oh, okay. I always go with cheap pizza, you know, those $5 Little Caesar deals or one of those. Or if I want to splurge, I go to Papa Murphy's and buy one. But is that Domino's, when you go there, do they look like they're dying? Is the plaster falling down? Are the people who work there surly, angry, and they've just gotten their pink slips? I don't see any of those being possibly what's going on with that company. And there's the other part of fundamental analysis, getting off your ass and walking into these companies and looking. Is this company dying? Ask some questions of the people who work there. Get their rumors. Get the bad rumors and the good rumors and all that. That's fundamental analysis. You look at the numbers, but then you keep going to see what is actually out there in the real world. What I'm looking at here is a company that does seem to... Okay, now, next one that I'm going to bring up. And I'm going to bring up ratio analysis kind of in a not in a linear fashion at first. Oh, by the way, on ReggieNet right now, in the resources tab, I've got a... I've posted a financial analysis formula worksheet. Just for you. You might want to have it laminated and put it up on your refrigerator or something. Or not. Okay. Not. Here's one. Price to earnings. Now, the price to earnings is just what it says. The price per share divided by the most recent earnings per share. In other words, think about it like this. Think about it like this. This company's earnings over time, right now, right here, right here. Now, its earnings right now are some amount, earnings zero. Now, they're going to take some of those and they're going to send them off as dividends. The rest they're going to put into investment in the company. That investment will earn more money, some of which will be spun off into dividends, etc., but some of which will grow the company. Price to earnings ratio says how much is the market willing to pay right now for each dollar of money that the company has earned right now. In other words, the company is going to earn a buck, and part of that buck is going to go back into the company and grow the company, theoretically grow the stock, theoretically grow the stock price. How much money is the market willing to pay right now? In other words, how much money does the market believe the present value in the company's future of a dollar of earnings now? In this case, the market is willing to pay $40.31 for $1 of earnings now. The market has assessed that a dollar of earnings of this company now has a present value of future earnings of a little more than $40. Here's the deal. The higher the PDE ratio, PDE ratio is actually a measure of risk. PE ratio, it's like a beta, except it's a cruder, rougher measure. But it's no less valuable. The higher the price to earnings ratio, PE ratio, the riskier the security. In other words, the market right now is willing to pay $40 for $1 of current earnings on this company. That's a pretty steep price. That's a pretty steep price. The market saying $1 of earnings by Domino's right now is going to create a present value of future earnings of $40, or future value to the shareholders, I should say. Okay, now, long time ago, back in ancient times, when I was young, these price earnings ratios of 10, 15, 20 were considered really scary, high. Then came these giant run-ups in stocks, high speculation in the 90s, and people were batting an eye at 50, 80, 200. Heck, even in Japan, there were a couple of stocks during the run-up of the Japanese Nikkei in the 90s that had price-earnings ratios of 20,000. $20,000 would be paid for $1 of one of these companies' current earnings. And so now I'm supposed to say, well, 40 isn't so bad. Except that it's still, in my judgment, that's still scary, but it is actually times have changed. Let me show you one. Let me try Google, G-O-O-G. Let me see what its price-earnings ratio is real quick. 30. Try Apple. Isn't that interesting? Apple is, interestingly, notice that beta and PE ratio can actually give you conflicting information. Like, for example, with Apple, the beta is saying this is a very risky stock, but the PE ratio is saying not that risky. Whereas when we go back to DPZ, the beta is saying it's safe. The PE ratio is saying it's risky. That's why technical analysis on its own kind of falls apart. These aren't actually giving you misleading. They're not contradicting each other. You just have to know what the story is behind these numbers to be able to understand what's going on here. But anyway, that's price-earnings ratio. Okay, the earnings per share, it doesn't list earnings there. I'd have to go, let me go in and see the earnings right now. The current earnings on the company, you would take the price divided by the current earnings. In other words, the current net income per share. Okay, the price is just the price. To get the PE ratio, what am I looking at there? Domino's. You would take that price divided per share, that $149.55, divided by the earnings per share. And that would give you the price-earnings ratio. Okay? But something I was going to... I'm kind of glad you asked that. But, okay. Now, quick formula before I go on. And this is in that ratio sheet. Somewhere you probably have shown that. And I've said this earlier in the semester. We really don't care about numbers changes. Numbers change from one to another. But what we do care about is percentage changes. So in other words, I really don't care that Domino's fell by 93 cents. What I do care about is what percentage it fell by, in this case, 0.62%. Now, the formula for a percentage change, percent delta, is going to be the ending value minus the beginning value, all divided by the beginning value, times 100%. That gives you a percentage change. That is much more important for any kind of analysis, whether it is raw numbers, revenue from one year to the next, a ratio of two numbers from one year to the next, always, always a percentage change tells you a lot more than a dollar value change. So, anyway, let me go back over here. First things first. Consolidated statements of income. Seriously? There we go. Okay. And I can't emphasize this enough. And even on the quiz, you'll have enough time. The homework test, quiz and test, before they're going to give you a company. And they're going to say, get these numbers, get this percentage change, find this ratio. I mean, it's just arithmetic. So you have the time to step back and say, let's just look. Let's look at the dollar amounts just for a minute. Okay, on the revenue side, and I'm going to expand this because I can't see it worth a darn. Okay, First impression, for heaven's sakes, just an impression. Ma'am, what do you see? Revenue. Look at the revenue. What do you see? A lot of money. That's good, yes. It's growing, though. Grow good, positive growth good, negative growth bad. Now, the first thing that I might want to do is take 1.993 minus 1.082. Just do that real quick. Clear. 1.993 minus 1 point what? 802. Close parentheses, divided by 1.802. And I'm not, this is, notice, got to be careful with those tests and quizzes. They are absolutely bitchy about accuracy in decimal places. So be careful. Don't do what I'm doing here. I'm just doing back of the envelope stuff. Okay, from 13 to 14, growth of revenue was, about 10.6%. From 14 to 15, now I can look at the growth of revenue on the next ride, which would be 2.217 less 1.993, and I don't want to do this too much, quit it. Less 1.993, close the parentheses, divided by 1.993, 11.24%. 11.2%. Not spectacular, but the growth of revenue has accelerated. See what I'm doing there? I'm looking at the percentages, and I'm asking myself, well, how's the company doing? Okay. First, revenue is growing, and revenue is growing at a modest but positive rate. That's a good sign right there. I would say that right off the bat, the market is paying money for this stock, putting the price-to-earnings ratio at a fairly robust number because analysts, elves, and fundamentalists, elves and wizards are both seeing that this company's revenues are growing. And this is in a market that is not particularly friendly. Think about the pizza market. Okay? You've got a pizza joint has two sources of competition. It has, on one hand, the other national brands that are going to be beating it up with heavy marketing dollars, the whole nine yards, customer loyalty, and all that. And then you have these little places. How many are there probably here in a campus community? I mean, everyone and his brother is running a pizza joint out of a garage. On one side, they're making meth. On the other side, they're making pizzas. We deliver both. Breaking Bad pizza. You know, that's a heck of an, I should have thought, oh, anyway. You know, if you use that, I get a cut of the revenues. But anyway, look, do you see how it's a tough, tough market? It is a bear of a market. Because you've got these big things kicking you on one side. You've got these little ones on the other side. And then you've got new entrants all the time. Have any of you ever been to the new Pizza Ranch here in town? Yeah, it rules. It is good because they got fried chicken there and pizza. And if you don't see the pizza you want, all you can eat, you can ask them and they'll make you a pizza. They didn't make the pizza I asked for. For some reason, they thought that was weird. But anyway, look, the point here is that a company like Domino's that's surviving and growing in revenue and growing at an accelerating rate, well, right there, that company has made friends with me. Now, though, The next thing would be, all right, what's their cost of sales? Are they maintaining? Is the cost of sales growing faster? Okay, oh, look at, wait. Well, there's an interesting thing. Am I missing something here? Wait. Look at this. Well, I've never run into that one before. Oh, that sucks. They're listing operating margin as revenue minus cost of goods sold. Is that what I'm seeing there? Yes, it is. That's a very non-standard definition. Unless they're calling everything else, every expense they have, a cost of sales, there should be a gross margin, then all of these other expenses before you get to operating margin. But they are calling cost of sales every expense. Normally, and I showed you this last time, normally, this one, I had told you this can happen. Okay, you got your revenue minus your cost of goods sold. Most financial statements that are presented these days, at least for the SEC's purposes, don't give you this intermediate gross income line. But it should be there. And then minus your selling, general, and administrative expenses, that gets you your operating income. Sometimes called, as I had mentioned before, EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Then you've got your minus your interest expense, and that gets you your earnings before taxes, minus your taxes, and this is a little simplified, but then you get your net income, okay? Net income flows to the statement of retained earnings, minus your dividends, adds to what your original, your beginning retained earnings were to get your bottom line. Notice here on this one, though, there is no expense manifest that there would be here, like wages and salaries, utilities, meals and entertainment, postal expense, all that kind of stuff, depreciation. It should be broken out, even depreciation especially, because we need to add that back in to get cash, to understand cash flow, because depreciation is not a real expense. And yet it's not showing there. Now that's an interesting thing that kind of clips me down a little bit on my ability to show this one. I should have been a little more careful there. But, okay, bottom line is what I can do is cost of sales. We can still do something okay here. My curiosity would be, all right, we've got revenue growing. What is the story about the costs growing? Okay. And here I can't break down costs in a really meaningful way. So I'm just going to say costs. From 13 to 14, how did my costs move? Where the heck did I put my... Oh, there it is. Okay. And please, someone, I do make mistakes tragically. Okay. Okay, open parenthesis. We're going to take 1.399 less 1.253... 1.253, close the parentheses, divided by 1.253. Oh, so in other words, costs grew at 11.7% from 13 to 14. That's bad. Because revenue didn't grow that fast. You see it? My costs grew a little faster. That's a bad thing. Let's see how they did. Let's see if they got that under control on the next round. So in this case, I'm going to take 1.553, 1.533, 1.533 less 1.399, close the parentheses, divided by 1.399, son of a dog, they got it. Forgive me. Look at that. They brought the cost under control. That is an even stronger buy signal on this. They did have a problem with their costs growing faster than their revenues were. The revenues were growing aggressively, well, in the 13 to 14 period. But their costs were outpacing. But they got their major act together, brought their revenue up to a faster growth level, and they dropped this hard. They brought this down hard. I mean, that's a serious cost containment they did on that period. Now, there are a couple of possibilities here. It might not have been as bad as I think it is. I'm thinking in 13 to 14. This might have been some period when they were redoing stores, or they were doing more training of their employees, or they were starting to experiment with different menu items before they got a new menu established. I'd have to look at the fundamentals, look at the menus of the company, look at their policies and procedures and see what was going on. One way or the other, though, I see now, I see even more reason why the market is fairly favorable to this stock. Growing decently, cost control is kicking in really good. Now let's go down. Last thing that I'll do on this one. I'm going to look at their net income. Okay, at the bottom line, this is what belongs to the shareholders. Residual claims have been satisfied in a timely manner all above this. So now I can look here. By the way, notice liquidity rate, times interest earned. Before I do that, times interest earned. All right. Interesting. They've got interest coming in and interest paying out. I mean, the interest coming in is not all that material. The times interest earned is you take their interest expense divided by, I'm sorry, their interest income divided by their interest expense. So this is one of those debt ratio, debt things. Times interest earned is your earnings before interest and taxes. That's your op income, operating income, divided by your interest expense. In other words, how many times over can you pay your interest? How many times over does the money you have left to pay interest after you paid all your other bills, how many times over can you pay it? In this case, I'm looking here, and I'm just going to throw the numbers out to see how it looks, just the profile of the changes from year to year. If I do interest expense, 313, okay, good grief. Okay. If I do that, 313, 811, 313, 811, divided by, I'm not going to put in that 160 positive. It's so small, it's not really going to affect anything too much. Divided by 3.5 times over. That's not a percentage, that's a multiple. That's a factor. So in 2013, they had 3.5 times the money they needed to pay their last big bill, the interest expense. In 2014, 345, 361, 345, 361, divided by their interest expense, 86,881. Improved. It went up to almost four times over. And then in the most current year for fully reporting, I've got 405-439-405-439 divided by 99537. Again, it went up. In other words, the company is not growing its exposure to liabilities, debt pay, interest payments, relative to its money that it has to pay those. In other words, it would be like your income is growing, but your interest on borrowings you got isn't growing at the same pace. You're getting better. There's more money left over at the end of every month. So, and it's not anything huge, spectacular, but it does show prudent management. They're not gathering more debt and getting themselves down a rabbit hole with it. They are growing their revenue, growing their operating income, but they're not saying, oh, we got more money, now let's take on more debt so we have more interest to pay. They're not doing that. That's prudent. So far I'm seeing a fairly robust buy signal. Last one I'm going to show you on this page is your what's called the net margin. Net margin is your net income divided by your revenue. In other words, how many pennies of every dollar of sales survived for the shareholders? And I'm just going to do the last year. I'm going to take the net margin. 192,789 divided by 2216,528. About 8.7 cents of every dollar at the sales line survived to be claimed as residual by the shareholders. Now, some of that is going to go to the dividend. The rest is going to be plowed back. Now, here's the deal with net margin. It can be all over the place. I can't even tell you. First, you'd have to look at the industry. What's the industry average for net margin in pizza joints? I mean, it would probably be fairly low. Competitive markets tend to have low net margins. Also, old capital intensive companies tend to have low net margins as well. Think about this. If you look at the net margin of a massive multinational oil and gas company, you might see a net margin that is a penny or less. But because they earn insane billions of dollars in revenue, that's still a huge pile of money for the shareholders. So I can't tell you whether let me give you an interesting example. In my company, my net margin floats at around 14%, 14 to 16%. I don't even know if that's typical for artists. So you have to say, well, what are the comps? Is it going up? Is it going down? We'd like to say it's going up, your net margin. That means that you're getting revenues growing faster than all your costs are. But that's about it. It's really hard to call. also, don't think that a net margin that is small for any company necessarily is a bad thing. Some of the biggest love children for Wall Street types are companies like, have you ever shopped at Aldi's? Yeah, I do. I hate it. I feel dirty after I've done it. They make you pay a quarter to have a shopping cart. They put your food on the floor in these boxes. But Aldi's is a business model that is phenomenal. Another one that is phenomenal is Dollar Tree and Dollar General. Because if you think about it, you could have your expenses in one of those stores could be on a given day, you're paying some wages, a minimum wage to a few workers who can't find anything else to do, so they work there at these low wages. You've got essentially this inventory that you buy at ludicrously low prices mostly from foreign sources and from some American sources, and you have a crappy building and some lights on. and maybe a telephone and possibly a toilet. But you're talking about expenses that might run in that store $120 a day. Now, suppose that they sell 140 items at $1 each. That's just $20 per store that survives, roughly speaking, at net income. That's horrible. No, it's not. That's incredible. Think about what happens if you make $20 of profit a day and you have 5,000 stores open every day. $20 times 5,000, well, I'll be darned, that's $100,000 a day in your stores, 360 days a year. Even better than that, if one of your stores burns down, your business model doesn't even feel it. You can keep growing and growing and growing, making $20 a store as long as you have 5, 6, 8, 10,000 stores worldwide. You are going to make a fortune in that kind of a business model. You don't have to have a net margin that is awesome. All you have to do is have a modest net margin and a lot of places earning that same net margin. Keep that in mind if you ever think about starting a business. And that, of course, is one of the things about franchising and all of that that makes it strong. Okay, a couple more ratios just to, for you ratio hounds out there. You know, okay, here's, these are kind of overtalk, liquidity ratios. In other words, like for example, your current assets over your current liabilities. That's how many times over. This is called your current ratio. Current ratio is nothing but your current assets over your current liabilities. It's how many times over you can pay your relatively short-term bills with the stuff that you could pull out short-term to pay them with. Now, if this, in accounting or in any other course you've taken in business, have they told you a rule that you should have your current liabilities and current assets fairly close to each other? I don't know if they still teach that rule or not. It's not true. Some companies have a current liabilities that are a current assets that are much higher than their current liabilities. Other companies have current assets that are much lower than their current liabilities. The deal is this. It's great to have a lot of liquidity. That's current assets. And it's great to have that liquidity in case you have to pay off your current liabilities quickly. However, liquid assets don't earn you jack. Liquid assets don't earn you hardly anything. I mean, money in a money market account, really? What, a whopping 0.1%? Money in your accounts receivable, that's not earning you a thing. People owe you money and they're not paying you. So if you have your current assets over your current liabilities too high, I would be a little worried about that. Too low, I might be a little bothered by that too. Okay, the next one. Oh. The quick ratio. There's an old term for it. It's called the acid test. You'll hear me call it the acid test, but its technical name, I guess, is the quick ratio. The quick ratio. It's simply the same thing as this one, except that you take out inventory. Because inventory in liquidation, liquidatable value of inventory, is almost nothing. So in other words, that's really not something that you can even count on current liabilities, sorry. Okay. I mean, you can get, your inventory, who's going to buy your inventory? Odd lots, something like that. That's a sad part, too, is because a lot of companies have a lot of their value, especially in the current assets section, is in their current inventory. And I mean, that inventory, yeah, it's got that book value you wrote, what you paid for it, but what's the market going to pay you if you have to liquidate it? Pretty much nothing in a lot of cases. So, by the way, there's one old school one, and I think I even put it in my formula sheet. They don't talk about it in the book. I don't think I've seen it in years in a book. But it's an old one. It's called the burn ratio. The burn ratio. It's a really easy one. It's just your cash and marketable securities over your current liabilities. In other words, if we are, sir, you're familiar with the zombie apocalypse, right? Okay. Now, if there is really a zombie apocalypse, you don't have time to sell your accounts receivable. You don't have time to sell your inventory. You don't have time to sell your prepaid insurance expense. All you have time for is to get the money out of the petty cash drawer. And also hand the zombies his brains. Okay? That's it. Realistically, this is the one at the end of the day, if it really did come down to an apocalyptic event, all you've got is your cash and your marketable securities. The rest of it, I mean, you wouldn't have time to get rid of the rest of it. Quite honestly. But like I said, this is one nobody, well, not anymore, hardly anybody teaches this. It's not in the books. But I thought I'd bring it up because, let me see if I think I even have that on that sheet of mine that I printed up. Oh, I sure do. That's what that is, a burn ratio. Okay. A couple of others that I'll bring up here that'll become important later in the course. Some of these, you can just read about them. None of them are really tough, but big one, debt to assets ratio. It's just what it says. It's your long-term debt divided by your total assets. That's all it is. This number would be between 0 and 100%. And there's a variation on debt to equity ratio, but I like this one better because it gives me a percent. Companies are all over the board. There are some companies that have very low debt to total asset ratios. Other companies have incredibly high debt to total asset ratios. We'll get into a topic later in the course called the optimal capital structure. However, know this, as a general rule, as the debt to assets ratio goes up, the return on equity will go up too. This is called the gains to leverage. And if I forget, you remind me. Next week, I will tell you how you can make a fortune as a real estate mogul using gains to leverage. Or you'll crash and burn and you'll live in a hovel under a bridge for the rest of your life. One or the other. But the more debt you fuel your equity with, the stronger the return on equity grows. In other words, a company that says, well, we never use debt, our debt to assets ratio is zero, that's a company that is denying its shareholders the gains on return on equity that could happen with some debt in the capital structure. This brings us to one of the most important terms in all of finance that I need to mention before I go any further. OPM. Have you been taught this term before, OPM?
No.
Do you know what it is? You have no idea. It's going to sound like I'm making a joke, but I promise you I'm not. It's other people's money. Other people's money. That's what OPM means. It is intimately connected to gains to leverage, which is intimately connected to the return on equity. In other words, if you have a choice between using your money and someone else's, if you have a choice between putting your money all at risk and his money all at risk for your benefit, which are you going to do? That's right. Yeah, with those T-shirt, that Redbird T-shirt, he probably has a lot of money. He doesn't need it all. He probably doesn't. I mean, what, you know, some, you know, something like oil of Aragon for the hair, but you know, other than that, seriously. And I'm not. This sounds like a joke. It's not. This is how we grow the balance sheet. This is how we grow the income. We borrow money. And you see, and I'll give you the window on how, what I'm going to show you on Tuesday. But it works like this. You and I are, I mean, we're bro team. We're buds. So we go through life together, holding hands, jumping up and down. When I spring high in the air, you spring high in the air. When I trip, you trip, okay? But, you see, I am spending energy pulling you along with me. With you, all I have to do is have you wave to me and say, hi, and I can frolic on my own, slow motion through the hills. You don't drag me down. Every penny I earn, my bro earns the same penny, percentage of that penny. With you, I pay you a fixed interest expense. You get no more. If I am growing my company and my ROE is 40%, you get 40% as well as I do. But you, if I borrow money from you, I just pay you the interest. You don't get any cut of my profit, not a bit. You don't grow as I grow. I just pay you off and leave, okay? Do you understand a little bit about why other people's money is so powerful? It's because I don't have to keep him with me. I'm not married to him. I'm not married to you. That's nasty, man. But anyway, you see, the point, though, is that that's why other people's money is so important and powerful in finance. Is because I just pay you a fixed amount and then I'm done with you. But with another shareholder, if I'm selling stock and you become one of my shareholders, everything I earn, you earn with me. I don't like that. That's why ROE is going to grow with debt to asset ratio as I use more debt and less equity. So let's look at the, real quick. Now, return on equity, and this is also return on ROA and ROE. The warning here is that if you do ROA, that's net income divided by, you got to switch back and forth here. Net income, 192,789. I'm going to take 192,789. 192,789 divided by my total assets. This will give me my ROA. 602. Oh, no. Whoa. Okay. Other assets. Where's my assets? Come on. Where's my assets? Okay. 799, 845. 799,845. So the return on assets of this company, ROA, for the most recent year, ROA, which is net income over total assets, for the current year, for the most recent year, was 24.10%. In other words, that all of your assets taken together are earning a 24% return. That's about all you say of it. Now the ROE, the return on equity, is how much your equity not just your total assets, but your equity is earning. In this case, the ROE, switching back for the, this is way too much like work. I think I got Zika or something. 192789 divided by, now I'll go back to that. Go back to the equity, total equity, total shareholder. See, can't do it. Because the book on this company's got negative equity. Even though it doesn't, I can't calculate the return on equity. Because it's a negative number. Shoot. Oh, well, it is that, though. I need to bring up something really important. Return on assets. The bigger, the better? No. Yes, you want that return on assets to be strong. You want it to grow. But if it gets too big, I get worried. And I'll tell you why I get worried in a real-world example where human lives are at stake. Look, ROA is your net income divided by your total assets. In other words, it's how well your total assets are working, how hard they're working. Okay, now, story comes from the refining industry. In the 70s was the last time for many, many years that refineries were being built in the United States. Build them, and then they just started bringing more and more oil through them, cracking it, sending it out to the country and the world. More oil every year on these refineries. No more total assets, but net income going up. Those assets were working harder and harder. Net income was rising against flat total assets, so you got the ROA going up, up, up. Analysts love that. Look at that ROA. Boy, they're making those assets work hard. Until the refineries started to explode. Humans were killed by the dozens, by the hundreds, one after the other after the other. I mean, you might be old enough to remember the news stories in the early 2000s, refineries just blowing up and killing people and making towns get evacuated. That was because they were not investing in the total assets, in their assets. They were just working them to death. Net income was going up. So yeah, ROA is spectacular. It's the same thing with companies that work their employees to death. They flog them. They push them. They just say, well, we don't need a couple of you. You two sons of dogs are fired. We're going to just work you harder because you're a manager. You can take over their job. But you start to burn out. You start to make mistakes. And finally, one day you see that ultimate, you have that final ultimate question. And you answer it, FTS. Fancy that scenario going to work tomorrow. No, you walk away. You begin to bleed off. Oh, we're going to save money. We're going to fire those old geezers. Who needs them anyway? Oh, well, then suddenly your knowledge base begins to compress, and all the young workers who aren't ready for the heavy loads start being made to do things that they can't do, and then they're made to feel like crap when they can't do it. You see, this is one of the problems with cost savings with your assets, your human assets, your physical assets, your capital assets and all that, is that over time, you don't have to invest. You can save money every year, cost cutting, every year. And in the end, you'll certainly get your net income keeps going up and up. Your costs are going down, so your net income just keeps going up. But at the end of the day, there's a buckling point. There's a breaking point for refineries, for employees at companies, and all of that kind of stuff. And this is one of the things that is not, still to this day, the Wall Street boys, They'll tell companies, you fire, you lay off, you get rid of a bunch of your employees, and we'll buy a pile of your stock, and your stock will go through the roof. And the slavish companies will say, oh, yes, evil master. And they'll do it, and the Wall Street boys just don't understand still that all they're doing is postponing the day of reckoning. They want that ROA to go up. Yeah, it sure as hell will. But sooner or later, it'll come crashing down all over them. That's the basic line of that. Now, let me take you on one more journey here. I don't really care about the DuPont ratio and all that kind of stuff, but Okay. I do want to bring up plowback and dividend. Sometimes this one is actually not that easy to find. Plowback. And dividend payout ratio. And the plowback ratio. Okay, this one is your dividend per share divided by your earnings per share. It's not, in other words, how much of every dollar of net income. Earnings is another way of saying net income. How much of every dollar of your net income are you giving to the shareholders? And your plowback ratio is just one minus your dividend payout ratio. In other words, it's how much of every dollar you're putting back into the company. The trade-off, and I've talked about this before, and I'll talk about it more. You give your shareholders a dividend. That makes them happy now. But you are doing that at the cost of not having that money to put back into the company. So some companies, their dividend policy is, we're not going to pay a dividend. We are going to grow aggressively. That would be a higher risk company for an investor because there's not going to be any dividend. Or it's going to be a modest. You're riding the nine. You're in there for the capital gain, which is riskier. So a low dividend payout ratio means that you could have a higher capital gain, but there is risk involved. The question that has driven analysts crazy for a long time, why do companies pay dividends? Are they they're throwing away money. They're just saying, look, if I give you a dividend, my company gives you a dividend as a shareholder, I am admitting that you know better what to do with that money than I do. Well, I guess my company sucks. I can't think of anything I can earn money on from that money, so I'll give it to you. You got to figure out something. Why would companies do that? Why would they give money, admit, I have nothing I can, I don't know, we don't have any projects we could use that money for. So we'll give it to you because you must be smarter than we are. You don't ever admit that. Even if you're a dumbass, you don't ever admit it. I mean, here's the thing that we know it's at least part of the answer. It comes from a branch of information science called signaling theory. Signals. The dividend is a signal that we can afford to do this. It's that filthy rich uncle of yours who comes and he gives you money. He doesn't have to. He just wants to make sure you know that he's got tons of money. It's me at an arts festival where I give little trinkets and postcards and pretty bookies to the kids. They're not going to be my customers for years. I'll be dead before they are. Ungrateful little bastards. I know, but I give it to them because I signal their parents that I am that well-heeled as an artist. I am that successful that I can do it. And that makes me look more valuable. That makes my signature on my artwork more valuable. You understand the signal? Years ago, as a consultant, I was doing consulting at a very large, what was called an alphabet house. Alphabet houses were the insurance brokers, brokerages. They represented companies, big massive companies for insurance, and to get insurance policies for all their different exposures and all that. Well, it was at Christmas time, and I was invited to the Christmas party at one of these alphabet houses where I'd done some consulting. I mean, this was a heavy-duty one. They were called alphabet houses because they had names like Marsh & McLellan, M&M, Alexander & Alexander, A&A, Johnson & Higgins, J&H. So this was one of the alphabet houses. And at this party, the president of the alphabet house got up before everyone. It was, I mean, there were prime rib. There was this expensive wine, Chateau de Derriere or something. I mean, it was just like unbelievable. He gets up there and he talks about how incredible their year was. They were making a fortune, and he wanted everyone there in the room to know it. He thanked them all for it. He just put on a lavish display. And at the end, he took a cigar out. This was at the time when you could smoke in buildings. And he put the cigar in his mouth, and he said, oh, yes, this was a very good year. And then he lit a $100 bill on a candle, and he lit his cigar with it. I thought, you're going there. You're going there. And then he just tosses the $100 bill into an ashtray. I'm like, signaling. He could burn up a $100 bill. It was just purely a signal that he wasn't even joking. And that's what we think a lot of dividend is. It's just a signal to the shareholder and to potential shareholders, we're good today. That's all I have for you. I thank you.